Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to this crowded room, but we're all jammed in, but it'll be an interesting night. Professor Murray Selby makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He created a lot of attention when he spoke here last August, and he's back again to talk on the topic climate change, what we know and what we don't. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. Professor Selby was educated at Georgia Tech. He was a professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder for 25 years. He's held a variety of appointments in Europe and Asia. His most recent book is Physics of the Atmosphere and Climate, published by Cambridge University Press. He's currently chair of climate at Macquarie University, and as I said, he's making a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, talking on the topic climate change, what we know and what we don't. Professor Selby, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Gerard, and thanks to the Sydney Institute for inviting me. Slow. You may be familiar with this scene. It's Sydney's latest and greatest, the new desalination plant. It's a financial commitment on 5 million residents to cover construction costs of some $2 billion. You may be familiar with this scene. It's Sydney's latest and greatest, the new desalination plant. It's a financial commitment on 5 million residents to cover construction costs of some $2 billion, an annual operating cost of $500 million. The project's motivation came in significant part from projections of future climate. Persistent drought, which officials were led to believe would leave metropolitan Sydney with inadequate water to sustain itself. And the rest is history. Almost everything you've heard about what climate is doing and will do rests on global climate models, GCMs. They are the source of climate projections. Compared here is current annual rainfall in the Sydney catchment against that projected for 2070. Orange and red denote arid conditions. Projected rainfall indicates widespread drying over the catchment, rainfall decreasing by 10 to 30%. Now, there are good reasons to have auxiliary support for the water supply. We've experienced droughts in the past, and we'll experience them in the future. But projections of future climate? In 2007, in the midst of a protracted drought, climate change was the flavor of the day. The divining of future climate was then, and continues to be, a platform for social advocacy. Fair enough, but your source of the future better be reliable. It's my observation that many of the proponents, indeed the most vocal, have no direct knowledge of the source, let alone understanding. Before undertaking a monumental enterprise, one whose financial commitment will continue in perpetuity, the confidence in your source of the future better be pretty high. And that's what we're going to discuss. To set the stage, let's consider three popular tenets of climate change. One, carbon dioxide is the most important greenhouse gas. Were it not for humans, it would be constant. What do you think? Two, CO2 controls global temperature, which has been warming steadily. Yes?
No.
No? Maybe. Three, we control atmospheric CO2. Therefore, we control global temperature. You control the horizontal. You control the vertical. And if you want, you control climate. Well, do you?
No.
If you answered yes to all three of these questions, see me afterwards. I want to talk to you about some stock. This is the instrumental record of CO2. It evidences a 30% increase since the last half century, when actual measurements of atmospheric CO2 began. The steady increase of CO2 has inspired a parade of efforts to find parallel changes of climate. The first problem on which its impact would be manifest is global mean temperature. This is the record of global temperature, inferred from surface thermometers. The end of the 20th century is warmer than the beginning, by just under a degree. But it's hardly a consequence of steady warming. Rather, it results from consecutive decades of warming being incompletely canceled by consecutive decades of cooling. During the 19th century, global temperature meandered, increasing and decreasing by half a degree. After 1880, it experienced cooling. After 1920, it experienced warming. Then cooling during the 40s and 50s. Followed by another two decades when it just meandered. Then, in the late 70s, it again experienced warming. Until the late 90s. Since 1997, it's experienced no warming. If anything, global temperature has experienced gradual cooling. For the last decade and a half, global temperature is the most fundamental climate property, the one on which others rest. It's also the most robust, because regional changes cancel when averaged over the Earth. Plotted here is temperature over Southeast Australia. It fluctuates between years by 1 to 2 degrees. Such fluctuations are responsible for extreme regional conditions, like heat wave and drought. In blue is global mean temperature. Fluctuations in one property have no consistent relationship to fluctuations in the other. The two are uncorrelated, virtually independent. Notice, however, that over Southeast Australia, during the last half century, there was a systematic drift to warmer temperature. During the 80s and 90s, global temperature experienced similar warming. Yet during the 60s and 70s, it did not warm. Even though Southeast Australia did. During early decades of the 20th century, Southeast Australia experienced cooling. Yet global temperature experienced warming. The two properties exhibit no systematic relationship, not even on decadal timescales. Displayed above is the same information, but now for California. Notice that during the last half century, when Southeast Australia experienced warming, California did not. During early decades of the 20th century, when Southeast Australia experienced cooling, California experienced warming. Fluctuations over California are also uncorrelated with global temperature. Likewise, they're uncorrelated with fluctuations over Southeast Australia. Changes in one region are largely independent of changes in the other. Therefore, averaging over the Earth, which yields a global mean temperature, leads to a cancellation of such changes. They're responsible for extreme regional conditions, but they have little relationship to global temperature. California's temperature displayed is the average of thermometers in rural areas, which underwent little urban development during the 20th century. The record at the top also displays temperature for California, but now averaged over thermometers near populated urban centers. Unlike rural areas, they underwent major development of infrastructure, roads, buildings, and other structure that traps heat. Even though it describes the same area, temperature is now significantly warmer. It also exhibits systematic warming. Conspicuously, during the last half century, that's when Southeast Australia underwent similar urban development, exhibiting similar warming. The upshot, sites of major urban development are warmer and warm faster than other sites. This local phenomenon is the urban heat island effect. It's why the CBD remains warmer at night than the surroundings. You didn't need a climate expert to know that in summer, bitumen gets hotter than grass. The urban heat island effect biases thermometers in urban areas like metropolitan Sydney. It has little to do with global temperature. Prospective impacts of climate change. We've all heard them. Here's a sample from government agencies and media reports. More heat waves. More cold waves. More droughts. More floods. More hurricanes and tornadoes. Less snow. More snow. More plagues. More locusts. More famine. More poverty. Stunted agriculture. Magnified agriculture. More mental illness and suicides. More alcoholism. More crime. More allergies. More bugs. More rats. More bats. More earthquakes. Yes, earthquakes. And if there are more earthquakes, more tsunamis. More pollution. Not CO2, real pollution. More migration and conflict. More icebergs. Less icebergs. Have I forgotten anything? Mutant sharks. And in the U.S., a baseball player has concluded that climate change causes more home runs. Well, you get the idea. Now, for each of these prospective impacts, there is a veritable industry of studies. Well, maybe not for the home runs. I was curious to see how they were treated in Australia. I've been here for 4 years, and I thought I had a handle on research and funding in Australia. But I must say, this was an eye-opener. These are studies funded by the Australian Research Council, the National Climate Change Adaptation Program, and the New South Wales Department of Environment and Climate Change, all in the name of climate change. Among them, the impact of climate change on the brown butterfly, managing the impact on the Great Barrier Reef, 1.1 million, that's $3 per square kilometer. The impact of climate change on global governance, 1.6 million. Modeling and projection of climate change, 21 million. The impact of climate change on orchids, on emotion and morality, on literature and science fiction, on fiddler crabs, on feasibility and common sense. The impact of climate change on mud, seaweeds, plant sexuality, moss, culture and romanticism, and the impact of climate change on the cuckoo. These diverse studies have one thing in common. All rest on projections of future climate by GCMs, just like the desalination plant. Anything that might be learned from these studies can be no better than the veracity of those climate projections. And that brings us to the underpinning physics, what GCMs attempt to simulate. That's where CO2 comes in. To understand its role, we must consider the global balance of energy, which controls global temperature. Energy is transferred in and out of the Earth's atmosphere system through radiation, which is emitted by all matter. Two forms are involved. Short radiation is emitted by the sun. It's visible radiation, sunlight, with wavelengths of order half a micrometer. What's not reflected back to space is absorbed, chiefly by the Earth's surface. It acts to warm the Earth's atmosphere system. Long-wave radiation is emitted by the Earth's surface and atmosphere. It's infrared radiation, with wavelengths of order 10 micrometers. Long-wave radiation is emitted to space, acting to cool the Earth's atmosphere system. Although not visible to the human eye, infrared radiation is emitted by all matter. Take your right hand and position it a few millimeters from your cheek. The warmth felt in your hand is infrared radiation emitted by your cheek. Now, rotate your head 90 degrees. Come on. You didn't realize this was going to be a test. Your cheek is an analog of the Earth's surface. Your hand is the atmosphere. It absorbs infrared radiation emitted by your cheek. Your hand also emits infrared radiation back down, which is then absorbed by your cheek. How shortwave and longwave radiation affect temperature is governed by the global energy budget. Now, I want you to take a deep breath. Are you ready? Here we go. The energy budget is measured in units of light bulbs. One light bulb is 100 watts. Shortwave energy from the sun arriving at the top of the atmosphere is some 300 watts per meter squared. That heating is equivalent to three light bulbs illuminating one square meter. Of that, 30% is reflected back to space by cloud, ice, and snow. If you can see those features from space, that shortwave energy is reflected back into your retinas. Hence, it's not absorbed by the Earth atmosphere system. The rest, the 70% not reflected back to space, is absorbed. Most of it passes directly through the atmosphere, which is transparent to shortwave radiation. It's then absorbed by the Earth's surface, which is thereby warmed. To maintain equilibrium, the Earth's surface emits longwave radiation, about 400 watts per meter squared, which acts to cool the Earth's surface. Very little of it passes directly through the atmosphere, which is opaque to longwave radiation. Instead, 95% of that longwave radiation, some 400 watts per meter squared, is absorbed by the atmosphere, chiefly by water vapor and cloud. They are the primary greenhouse absorbers. CO2, methane, and all other greenhouse gases account for only 4 watts per meter squared, 1% of the absorption. To maintain equilibrium, the atmosphere also emits long-wave radiation. Almost as much is emitted back down. Representing the greenhouse effect, it too warms the Earth's surface, offsetting the energy lost through emission. In this picture, the atmosphere behaves as a blanket. The more atmospheric absorbers of long-wave radiation, the more layers of the blanket, and the greater is warming of the Earth's surface by downwelling long-wave radiation. As CO2 contributes to atmospheric absorption, increasing CO2 adds layers to the blanket. However, 99% of the blanket comes from water vapor and cloud, and like everything else in this dynamic system, they change. Much of the long-wave energy emitted upward by the Earth's surface, cooling, is offset by long-wave energy emitted back downward by the atmosphere, warming. To maintain equilibrium, the Earth's surface must therefore also transfer heat away mechanically. Through conduction and convection, vertical air motion that carries heat away from the surface. Associated with cloud and rainfall, it accounts for 30% of overall heat transfer from the Earth's surface. Two orders of magnitude greater than long-wave warming by CO2. Most of the mechanical heat transfer from the Earth's surface comes from the ocean. What can we say definitively about that contribution? Three features make the ocean pivotal. First, observations of the ocean are limited, chiefly to the surface, which can be monitored by satellite. Buoys provide a recent record of the top 20% of the ocean. The rest, however, is virtually unobserved. The second feature pertains to our ability to interpret long-term changes, which requires averaging over many internal cycles of the system. Only then can we truly distinguish a long-term drift from an internal oscillation. The Earth atmosphere system is dynamic, changing on many timescales. Weather operates on a timescale of days. Seasons operate on a timescale of a year. The sun oscillates on a timescale of a decade. The ocean oscillates through its overturning circulation, the so-called abyssal circulation. It operates on a timescale of 1 to 2,000 years. Changes embedded in that internal oscillation will be manifest over centuries. Lastly, the ocean's large mass gives it a heat capacity, which is huge. Even minuscule heat transfer from the ocean can produce significant warming of the atmosphere. 1 degree of atmospheric warming has occurred during the 20th century, would result from ocean cooling smaller than 0.0005 degrees. Even if we had measurements of the deep ocean, how many of you believe that observations are accurate to within 0.0005 degrees? In fact, observed variability of ocean temperature is orders of magnitude greater. And that brings us to simulations of climate, the basis for climate projections. They rest on GCMs, some 24 run by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They're relied upon for changes of regional climate, which dictate extreme conditions like heat wave, drought, and flooding. Plotted here is the projected change of rainfall during the 21st century, averaged over all models. Light brown indicates drying along the eastern seaboard, including the Sydney catchment seen earlier. At the bottom is the punchline. It describes the consistency among models. Dark brown indicates that all models predict drier conditions. Dark green indicates that all models predict wetter conditions. Most of Australia falls into the category white. Half of the models predict drier conditions, and half of the models predict wetter conditions. Included is the Sydney catchment. To be fair, rainfall is a poorly simulated climate property, even under mean conditions. That's because it's tied to cloud processes, which must be parameterized ad hoc. On the other hand, it is those ill-defined processes that comprise mechanical heat transfer from the Earth's surface. They account for 30% of overall heat transfer, two orders of magnitude greater than long-wave warming by CO2. more representative of other regional properties is temperature, deviations of which lead to heat wave and drought. Like all climate properties, temperature is controlled by the energy budget, the balance between energy going into a region and out. Forcing this balance is energy transfer at the top of the atmosphere, shortwave radiation going in and longwave radiation going out. Our ability to simulate what goes on beneath the top of the atmosphere, regional temperature, cloud, wind, and so forth, can only be as accurate as our ability to simulate this radiative forcing of regional climate. Those radiative properties were observed by three satellites of the Earth's radiation budget experiment. Average values of shortwave energy absorbed and longwave energy emitted to space were evaluated over the Earth. They were then compared, region by region, against simulated energy transfer in 24 GCMs of the IPCC. Plotted here as a function of latitude is the discrepancy in shortwave energy absorbed between GCMs versus that observed. The error in shortwave energy absorbed by a region is of order 30 watts per meter squared. Remember the contribution of CO2 in the energy budget? It's only 4 watts per meter squared. That's how much additional warming would result from a 100% increase of CO2. The air in shortwave energy absorbed is an order of magnitude greater. At the bottom is the same information, but for outgoing longwave radiation. The air in longwave energy emitted to space by a region is of order 20 watts per meter squared. It, too, is an order of magnitude greater than the additional warming from a 100% increase of CO2. The prospective impact of increased CO2 is buried in the error of simulations, notably of water vapor and cloud, which dominate the energy budget. It should be noted that these regional errors refer to average conditions, not deviations, and certainly not extreme conditions, which are infrequent and far more challenging to simulate. We're not doing as well as we thought. Perhaps by focusing on regional conditions, we've expected too much. Let's cut to the chase. Let's consider the most fundamental climate property, the cornerstone of climate change, global mean temperature. If anything is going to carry the signature of increasing CO2, it will. After all, climate models reproduced its previously observed warming during the 80s and 90s. That led many of us to speculate, well, maybe they are getting it. But reproducing the known change of global temperature, while suggested, is not a strong test of predictive skill. That experiment is called a hindcast. The real test is a forecast, predicting future evolution. That's tantamount to a double-blind test, the standard of rigor required in clinical trials of pharmaceuticals. Neither the patient, here the model, nor the clinician, the guy running the model, then knows the outcome. In blue is the forecast evolution of global temperature, averaged over 24 models at the IPCC. It increases monotonically, achieving values 3.5 degrees warmer by the end of the 21st century. The increase of global temperature should correspond to increasing CO2. In fact, their correspondence is considerably greater. In green is the forecast evolution of CO2. It too increases, exceeding 800 ppmv by the end of the century. Global temperature doesn't just increase with increasing CO2. It tracks it almost perfectly. In the model room, changes of CO2 and global temperature are isomorphic. They have exactly the same form. Their relationship is so tight, you don't even need a climate model. A fractional increase of CO2 entirely determines the fractional increase of global temperature. The simulated relationship is nothing short of profound. Here's why. Remember the global energy budget? It is what determines global temperature. CO2 contributes to the energy budget, but only at the 1% level. The one-to-one correspondence indicates that changes of global temperature remain in equilibrium with changes of CO2, but nothing else. Dominant contributions to the energy budget either do not change, or if they do, they are entirely enslaved to CO2. Those contributions can change only in direct proportion to CO2, which in the model world controls everything. Reflected shore wave energy, which depends on cloud and ice, cannot change. Mechanical heat transfer from the Earth's surface, which depends on the ocean circulation, cannot change. And 99% of long-wave energy absorbed by the atmosphere and re-emitted back downward, which depends on water vapor and cloud, cannot change. In the model world, changes in the global energy budget reduce to a highly simplified balance, driven exclusively by CO2. This means that 1% of the global energy budget wags the other 99%. In blue is the observed record of global temperature from the satellite MSU. In green, the observed record of CO2. The long-term evolution of global temperature parallels that of CO2 during the 1980s. It behaves less so during the 1990s, even accounting for the eruption of Pinatubo in 1992. But after the El Niño of 1997, CO2 continued to increase. Global temperature did not. Their divergence over the last decade and a half is now unequivocal. In the model world, global temperature tracks CO2 almost perfectly. In the real world, it clearly doesn't. Model world, real world. This leads to the following conclusion. In the model world, changes of CO2 and global temperature are closely related. In fact, within a scale factor, the two are synonymous. In the real world, they're not related. Not quite. The correct conclusion is they're not related directly, as they are under the simplified energy balance that prevails in the model world. They may still be related, but indirectly. Here again is the instrumental record of CO2. Notice, although CO2 increases steadily, its rate of increase varies from one year to the next. In some years, its increase is fast. In others, it's slow. In green is the annual increase. It must equal net emission of CO2. How much CO2 is added to the atmosphere each year, collectively from all sources and sinks. Human emission contributes to those sources of CO2, but only 4%. The rest, 96%, comes from natural sources and sinks. Net CO2 emission varies between years dramatically, by more than 100%. In some years, it decreases to almost zero. In others, it increases by almost 200%. These large changes of net CO2 emission are uncorrelated with the human contribution, which varies only gradually. They can follow, therefore, only from natural sources of CO2. It turns out that although unrelated to human emission, the changes of net CO2 emission are closely related to properties at the Earth's surface, mostly to just one, a property you've heard a lot about today. In blue is the history of surface properties. It closely tracks the history of net CO2 emission, achieving a correlation of 0.93. The leading order, the blue curve, is just global temperature. Increased temperature leads to increased emission of CO2 from natural sources. If net emission each year is proportional to temperature, we can collect the CO2 added during consecutive years. CO2 added to the atmosphere will then increase like the sum of annual temperatures. Temperature in one year, which represents the CO2 added that year, plus temperature of the next year, which represents the CO2 added that year, and so forth. CO2 from natural sources should then evolve, not like temperature, as CO2 does in the model world, but like cumulative temperature, the sum of annual temperatures, or for those who remember their HSC exam, like the integral of temperature. Recall, the blue curve is the observed record of temperature. The green curve is the observed record of CO2. In dotted blue is the integral of the observed record of temperature, the sum of observed temperatures. It corresponds to the CO2 added by natural sources. It closely tracks the observed record of CO2, even after the 1990s, when observed CO2 and observed temperature clearly diverged. In the model world, CO2 and global temperature are related directly. In the real world, they are also related, but differently. The distinctly different relationship between CO2 and global temperature represents a fundamental difference in the global energy balance between its evolution in the model world and the real world. The global energy balance is wrong. Everything else is window dressing. The different relationship between CO2 and global temperature becomes manifest after the 1990s, when their observed records diverged. However, once the temperature dependence of CO2 emission is accounted for, namely by natural sources, the two observed records are entirely consistent. These features of the observed evolution have the following two-pronged implication. In the real world, global temperature is not controlled exclusively by CO2, as it is in the model world. In significant part, however, CO2 is controlled by global temperature. I'll close on a philosophical note, a theme often brandished on this subject. The science is settled, proclaimed by even the highest echelons of Australian science. Meet Richard Feynman, described as the greatest mind since Einstein. I had occasion to meet Feynman during my brief time at Caltech, and it was then that he gave a commencement address wherein he spoke on science, pseudoscience, and how not to fool yourself. He noted, one can be easily deceived by deferring to the authority of supposed experts. Feynman developed a paradigm of such behavior, which he characterized as cult science. He cited the example of Millikan's famous experiment to measure the charge of an electron, on which Feynman remarked as follows. Millikan got an answer which we now know not to be quite right. It's interesting to look at the history of measurements after Millikan's. One is a little bigger than Millikan's. The next one is a bit bigger than that. Until finally, they settled to a number that is higher than Millikan's. Why didn't they discover the new number right away? When they got a number that was higher than Millikan's, they thought, something must be wrong. So they looked for and found a reason why something might be wrong. When they got a number closer to Millikan's, they didn't look so hard. And so they eliminated the numbers that were off. This is part of the long history of learning how not to fool ourselves, of having scientific integrity. Feynman also remarked on giving government advice. If you present only results that favor the government's position, you're not giving scientific advice. You're being used. Science is never settled. If something's settled, it's not science. When I got into this business 35 years ago, there were only a couple of GCMs in the entire world. Scientists who ran the models were the ones who developed them. They knew what was in the models, what the models could do, and more importantly, what they could not do. Most of those have retired from science or are contemplating it. They've been replaced by an industry of people who run models, producing so-called climate scenarios, yet have little or no grasp of the underpinning physics. The output then feeds a host of other models of social, economic, and other prospective impacts, not to mention government policy. Originally, these models were used as a tool to understand nature, narrowly designed experiments to elucidate observed features of the Earth-atmosphere system. Today, that role has been supplanted by a mechanical exercise, divining the future with complex models that can be run by almost anyone, yet in many respects are impenetrable and remain poorly understood. Model obscurity is therefore easily confused with infallibility. It's instructive to ask, what properties can climate models produce? The short answer is everything. The name of the game is therefore to separate the wheat from the chaff. The behavior you've seen makes one thing clear. Blindly accepting the output of climate models and marketing it on face value is less than meaningful. I don't want to leave you with a mistaken impression that climate models are hopeless. Simulation has become a key avenue of experimentation, an unprecedented opportunity for understanding nature. Expanding that understanding through science, not mindless scenarios to empower government bureaucrats, will enable climate models to develop improved predictive skill, providing insight into the coming season, the coming year, and eventually beyond. They have a ways to go.
Well, many thanks to Professor Selby for a stimulating address. We've got about 20 minutes of the questions and discussion. There are a lot of people here, so could you keep your comments brief or questions brief and to the point. So I guess from your conclusion, what you're really saying is that there'll never be settled science on climate change or anything else. If you just come back and talk to the back of the room like you were before. Yeah.
No science is settled. Even some of the most fundamental things that Einstein showed, we've seen recently, are not settled. They're always open to debate. There's always new perspectives to look at things. If you shut the door on it, you're not doing science. The whole point of science is to put up things. And there are always new observations that come into play. And if you allow those, then there's going to be some new angle on it that will make you rethink it. And the door on that should never be shut.
Okay, so question down the back. Don't stand up yet.
Why do warmer temperatures lead to more atmospheric CO2?
The disequilibrium between... The short answer is no one really knows for sure. But if you look at the budget of CO2, you find that there is a quasi-balance between sources of CO2 and sinks of CO2, most of which are natural. And the disequilibrium between that balance, how much out of balance you are, depends on a variety of properties, most conspicuously on temperature. And there isn't time to go into the details of several examples, but for example, the ocean, if you raise ocean temperature, you have outgassing of CO2. If you cool the temperature, it's more absorbing and so forth. So of the myriad of different processes that produce CO2 and absorb CO2 from the atmosphere, almost all of them depend on temperature. So if you increase the temperature, you end up pumping more in than you're pulling out, and that upsets the balance.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the scientists are all operating from the same basic data. And it's a question...
Sorry, just a minute. Come on.
And it's a question of how that data is interpreted. Is that so? And it has enormous consequences for resulting from the different interpretations.
The suggestion is the scientists are all talking from the same data, and the issue is how the data is interpreted.
Well, if you have a solid case, it should not rest on interpretation. The difficulty, and I think that this is what you're alluding to, is not so much the interpretation of the data, it is the subsequent processing of the data that gets the product out. There are raw measurements of data, and especially when you're dealing with surface thermometers, and there are all kinds of different thermometers from different places, and different countries use different things, they have to be intercalibrated, blah, 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 blah. But the group that does that, one group massages it this way, another group massages it that way, and so there are room for changes. And unfortunately, if you look at those data, they tend to evolve. And they tend to evolve quite distinctly just before the next IPCC report and so forth, which is one of the reasons that I have much greater confidence in satellite data than I do in surface thermometers. Now, there's no free lunch. The satellite data has its limitations as well. But it has a couple of unique advantages, and there are two that are noteworthy. One is it has global coverage. The thermometers, you only have thermometers where there are people, and the land coverage of the Earth is only about 30-35%. And the other is there's only one instrument and one technique, so you don't have 500 different things in order you can turn this and turn this and change these dials. You can't do that with satellite data. And those curves that I showed you at the end were satellite data.
Okay, there's a question here. Yeah.
Based on the scientific facts, may I ask your view on the carbon tax?
You can ask it, but it doesn't mean I'm going to answer it.
So the question was, or the point was, based on scientific facts, do you have a position on the carbon tax? And the answer is, well, you're not going to tell us. That's okay.
I'm going to let you decide yourself. And I'll remind you the following. I opened this talk and I pointed out that almost everything that you've heard about what climate is doing and will do rests on global climate models, GCMs. And then I showed you how the energy balance evolves in the model world, which is the basis for climate projections, and that in turn is the rationale for action on carbon dioxide. The carbon tax is the implementation of such action. But then I also showed you how the energy budget evolves in the real world. And I'll let you judge what to believe.
Okay, so the question here, and then we go here. Yep. Go on. Okay, down the back. Yep.
Yeah, how do we get a more balanced discussion on a worldwide basis along the lines you've been talking to people like the IPCC, capturing the public imagination? The
question is, how do you get a more balanced discussion worldwide on the topic you've been talking about?
Well, I think that's a fairly important question. Let me look at it from a historical perspective. Historically, the IPCC, this may surprise you, was regarded by many scientists, with a grain of salt. What gave them a mantle of legitimacy was this last report of 2007. And in that, the model sensitivity to CO2. When they included increasing CO2, the models reproduced the observed warming during the 80s and 90s. It's now clear why. In the model world, CO2 doesn't control just global temperature. It controls everything. It's the God gas. There's just one problem. In the real world, it's not. So, as new evidence comes in, if it is not excluded, if the door is not closed, either through a manifest or through, shall we say, other actions, then new evidence comes in, and you're constantly updating and looking at that, and the scientific community will be able to evaluate that. And when the scientific community evaluates this behavior, compares the observed behavior with models, it'll make a new assessment of it.
Question here?
Yeah. But I think the key, if I may, the key word to response to that is what you have to do is open communication. And you know what? There's a striking parallel with general free speech. If you shut down freedom of speech, whether it's academic or otherwise, you essentially back yourself into a corner. And if free speech is open, then you'll eventually see the other evidence and know what to do.
Is what I got from your talk last year, I might have been wrong, but that the great saver to us and for the world and climate is that the great sinks of forests in Southeast Asia, in South America and Africa. You didn't mention those today, but you still feel those are things that really absorb an awful lot of the problems that we have.
The suggestion is that a sink's going to resolve some of the problems that we have.
Well, I'm not clear that there is a problem, but the sinks are including in vegetation, but they're not the only sink. The ocean is a huge sink, and the reality is that there are many, many sinks and many mechanisms. We don't understand them all, except perhaps qualitatively, and we just do not have the observations to be able to quantify them, other than very gross terms. So what you saw at the end here, those huge fluctuations and how much CO2 was going into the atmosphere and going out, that's not coming from the human source. That's Mother Nature doing her thing.
Right, so the question, John, and then we go down the back to Trevor. Yep, John.
Professor, within the climate physicist community, are all physicists of a similar mind of the major issues that you've presented tonight? And the papers presented, and within the community, they basically accept basically the issues that you've presented.
Is that a statement or a question?
No, I'm asking you whether, like, in terms of papers presented at conferences or in learned journals amongst your community of specialist physicists in the climate sphere, is your views accepted as...
I think I can translate that. I think I translate it this way. When you go to climate science conferences, do people give you a cup of tea? I mean, do you feel at home, or are you excluded? I mean,
within
your own community.
Absolutely, absolutely. But if you think that science is all in phase, that everyone has exactly the same heartbeat, that is not science. People debate over things. They ask questions and they tear things apart. That's how we get to the truth. And, you know, what you heard after the last IPCC report in terms of the gauntlet going down, it's settled, no more discussion, that's not science. In normal conferences, you talk about these things. And I've presented material like this. And it stimulated a lot of discussion, which is what science is all about, thinking. This is fairly new material, but I should tell you that this material that I showed you, these aren't my results. These are the IPCC's results. I just showed you what they mean, what they imply.
So you do get a cup of tea.
I get dinner.
You get dinner. Oh, God. Trevor.
Yes. Given the disparities you showed between the climate behavior of New South Wales and California, is the global average temperature a meaningful statistic?
Well, I showed you that they are virtually independent. So if you're using global temperature to try to understand what's going on in a region, you're sadly mistaken.
There was a question about, for those who didn't hear, about the differences in temperature in California as against New South Wales, which came early in the paper. Now, we're coming to an end, so there's a question there. Yep.
Thank you, Professor Salvi, for your lecture. 100 years is a very short time to bother about comparisons. In your last very good lecture, you did not really believe in the ice, or you said, I understand, you did not believe in the ice core CO2, that the ice cores show the CO2 in the atmosphere has increased. Have you changed your opinion on that? Secondly, if the pH of the oceans is decreasing, obviously due to CO2 and carbonic acid formation, do you have any idea that that might be an increase in CO2 in the atmosphere?
Well, I think the thing to look at in terms of your question in the ocean is, what observations do we have of the ocean? And the answer is next to nothing. We have surface measurements. And then for about 10 years, we have these buoys that the oceanographers have thrown out and littered up the ocean, and they're sort of going around in the currents. But they only measure like the top kilometer or two. 80% of the ocean is unobserved. So the answer is that I showed you how small of a change in the ocean could entirely explain the change in the atmosphere. And until you have coverage and accuracy to do that, which is not going to happen anytime soon, you don't have all the pieces of the puzzle. And practically, you may never have them.
Final question.
Yes, the overarching problem with this whole thing is that the issue's become politicised. And science obviously should not be politicised. How do you think the scientific community worldwide allowed itself to get in such a silly situation?
That's a good question. Well, the way it happened was essentially that the IPCC... The IPCC's mission is to find and assess the risk of human-induced climate change. The answer was defined at the outset. That's not the modus operandi of a scientific body. If your mission is to find human-induced climate change, you better find it. Otherwise, you're not going to be in business very long. Let me add just a corollary to this. It's actually another proverbial quote from Feynman, which, different audience, but the same theme. And it cuts to the heart of the issue. Now, I'm going to discuss how we would look for a new physical law. In general, we would do so through the following process. First, we guess. The audience breaks up into laughter. No, don't laugh. That's the truth. Then we compute the consequences of the guess to see how what it would imply. And then we compare the computed results directly with observations to see if it works. If it disagrees with observations, it's wrong. And that simple statement is the key to science. It doesn't matter how beautiful your guess is. It doesn't matter how smart you are or who made the guess or what his name is. If it disagrees with observations, it's wrong. That's all there is to it. So ultimately, anything you do, whether it's models, it's the models run by the IPCC, the final vote is Mother Nature. You look at observations, you compare them, and if they disagree, back to the drawing board.
Many thanks. Just aside for a second. It's been a terrific night, and as you'll observe, Professor Murray Selsby is a brilliant communicator. I could understand him, and I'm sure the scientists in the room could understand him as well. And we've had a very important presentation tonight. I'm very grateful to Tom Parker, one of our members, who drew our attention to Professor Selby's work last year. This is his second speech here. Both papers have been very influential in the debate. The speech last August had significant attention across Australia and beyond, and I'm sure tonight's will as well. So thanks for a fine performance, and no doubt we'll have you back in the future. Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.